Welcome back to Mountain Money. In the 1920s, Charles Ponzi became known as a swindler for his money-making schemes. He promised clients a 50% profit within 45 days or 100% profit within 90 days. His scheme ran for over a year before it collapsed, costing his investors $20 million, and that's in 1920s money. And of course, his name has become synonymous with that kind of a scheme. And fast forward to the 21st century, where Bernie Madoff operated the largest Ponzi scheme in world history and the largest financial fraud in U.S. history. Prosecutors estimated that fraud to be worth $64.8 million. Now, Charles Ponzi initially relied on immigrants like him as investors, a kind of affinity fraud. Bernie Madoff targeted wealthy American Jewish communities, again, using his in-group status to obtain investments from Jewish individuals and institutions. Now, what all Ponzi schemes have in common is that they offer returns that are too good to be true. Yet people keep falling for these schemes year after year. And they seem to fall exceptionally often here in Utah. Utah has long been known as a state with a disproportionate incidence of fraud. And why is that? How do these scams occur? And why do people keep falling for them? We're lucky today to have as our guest Mark Pugsley, an attorney with Ray, Quinney, and Nebaker, someone who spent a great deal of time studying and trying to understand the Ponzi schemes and other kinds of frauds here in Utah. Good morning, and thanks for joining us, Mark.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, Mark, some people have labeled Utah with the ignominious title Fraud Capital of the United States. Is that fair?
Well, it is, actually, unfortunately. I wasn't sure about that until recently. I got asked that a lot when I would speak publicly, and I would say, well, you know, anecdotally, I think we have a high incidence of those schemes here. But then just last week, a friend of mine in Florida who runs a website called Ponzi Tracker did a study of all the different states, and he looked at the number of Ponzi schemes that each state had and also the amount of the losses in each state. And when you looked at the top five states, it was New York, Florida, Texas, Illinois, California. I think I got the order wrong, but they were all big, big states. And then number six was Utah, with even though Utah only had the 31st, was 31st in population, it was number six in terms of these scams. So when I ran those numbers on a per capita basis, sure enough, Utah had far and away the most Ponzi schemes per capita and the highest losses per capita if you take away the Bernie Madoff scam.
Now, Mark, we should give credit to the Deseret News. Their April 29th article quoted you on this subject, which Roger Goldman picked up on and reached out to you to have you come in. So we do want to give credit to the Deseret News article. Yeah. In there, you're quoted as saying that Utahs are simply too trusting. What do you mean by that, and how does it make it easier in Utah to promote a Ponzi scheme because of our trusting nature?
Well, Ponzi schemes, actually, when it comes to investment fraud, are just a subset of the big problem. We actually have a bigger problem than was even captured by this. It also, we have a problem here in Utah with people using what's called affinity fraud. And Ponzi schemes would be part of that. And what happens is, people tend to go to church together here in Utah, and you know the predominant religion, the LDS Church, has very close-knit communities where people attend church together every weekend. They also do a lot of other extracurricular activities together, very tight-knit. And those folks, unfortunately, I think when people trust each other, that in some contexts can be a good thing. But as I try to educate people about this, what I keep saying is, you know, being trusting is good in some contexts, but not in the context of investments, particularly when it's something that's not traded on any exchange and not offered through a traditional stockbroker. And so what I think happens here, and this is, you know, based on calls I get every week, this is my area of specialty in the law. I get calls every week from victims of these scams, and what I hear over and over is that they were approached by someone they knew, someone in their ward, someone in their stake, someone in their neighborhood, whatever it would be, even someone in their family, and they get, you know, pitched on some thing that makes outrageous amounts of money. And for whatever reason, people trust each other. And that's what I see over and over. I try to be careful because I do think trusting is okay. I don't want
to. It's a sad world if we can't trust anybody, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm cynical, but not that cynical. and yet, I do think there's another aspect to it, which is that we have some people who basically are not. They might say that so-and-so down the street has done due diligence on this investment, and so they don't have to do it. And so they trust each other kind of in a second-hand way, so they kind of drop their guard down because they know someone else who's gotten into this investment.
Or the fact that someone else, you know, that they respect does it just gives them a false sense of security. You know, it might be helpful if you give us a story or two about some of the larger Ponzi schemes that have happened here in Utah. I noticed in the paper a few days ago there was a rare corn dealer who's been indicted for a $200 million Ponzi scheme. Is that one that you're familiar with?
Yeah, very. I represent a number of folks who invested in this scheme. This is the largest one in Utah history, and it's just come out in the last few months, over, I think, $250 million in losses, primarily to Utah residents. And it is a situation where I think many people were wanting to buy coins or silver to, you know, in case society fell apart. You know, some people feel like if they have a bunch of silver in their basement, that's going to help them in some sort of catastrophic situation. I don't know if I agree with that, but setting that aside, the problem is buying a lot of silver and storing it in a safe place becomes very cumbersome. And so a guy named Galen Rust, whose family had been in the rare coin dealer business for a long time, generations actually, he started pitching people on a silver contract or a silver pool investment where they didn't actually take possession of the silver. They just put their money into this you know, account that he said was trading and making 40% a year, I believe, is what he was telling most of people. And lots of people joined into this. Many, I think there are several hundred investors who put their money in anticipation of these returns, and many of them made a lot of money on it. The problem is he never actually traded any silver. He never even had a silver trading account. So it was a fraud from the get-go. And he, you know, was using the money to buy racehorses and to promote this music business, but really none of it went into the purchase and sale of silver coins or silver bars or anything. So there's been the problem with these scams is that people get wiped out. I mean, honestly, the people I represent, a number of them put literally all of their retirement money into this deal, and now it's gone. And so this is the sad reality of these situations is people think that they can, you know, it's so great that they should just put all their money into it instead of, you know, being diversified. Most people understand the concept of diversification, but they kind of forget about that, and they put it all in anticipation of returns that were just way too good to be true, to follow up on your initial comment.
So Mark, high level, what should people do to protect themselves? I mean, I think this rare coin case is interesting because, you know, this is a guy who's, it sounds like, 2, 3, 4 generations, their family's been involved in it. It's a business that's been around a long, long time. What type, and until there's a violation, there's no record of violations as well. So what should the average person do to protect themselves and to eliminate or dramatically reduce the risk of being a victim of one of these Ponzi schemes?
Well, there's a lot of things that people can do. I think one of the things that I see that's very common in these situations is there's a secrecy element to it. A lot of times the promoters will say, hey, this is a secret deal. We've got some proprietary algorithm that we're using to trade, you know, Bitcoin or commodities, and super complicated. You wouldn't understand it, but just trust me on this. So I tell people, if you don't understand what you're investing in, don't invest in it. You should be able to see what's happening and understand where your money is going and how it's making money. Secondly, a lot of people, honestly, don't get any paperwork. I've seen numerous cases where people have handed over their whole retirement with little or no paperwork based on representations about returns. The next thing I see a lot is people who are the promoters of these are in a hurry. They're saying it's secret, and by the way, if you don't put your money in by, you know, this week or tomorrow, it's going to close, and you're just out of luck. So I tell people to slow it down, hire an attorney, hire an accountant, look into the background of the company, do a Google search on the people that are behind it, so at least find out if there's others who've had problems with this organization or company, whether it even exists or not. And there's a number of different due diligence items that any licensed stockbroker would do, and the problem is a lot of these scams are being promoted not by anyone who has a securities license, but rather someone who is not licensed to do that. So I tell people to work through licensed sales, people who are licensed to sell securities, stockbrokers and investment advisors, not insurance agents, by the way. They are not licensed to sell investments. So there's a whole bunch of issues that are out there, and people just unfortunately drop the ball. They don't follow through with the research that's necessary, and they end up putting their money into something that turns out catastrophic for them. And those are the stories I wish I would stop hearing, but unfortunately, I hear them every week.
Mark, I just want to add one piece to that. You mentioned investment advisors. My thought is when you're working with an investment advisor, somebody else should be custodying the asset, a third-party firm.
Yeah.
Like a Schwab or a Fidelity or a TD. I'm not recommending any of those as custodians. I'm just using it so people understand what a custodian is. Mm-hmm. So your advisor should not also be your custodian. And if that simple relationship had been put in place, Bernie Madoff could not have done. If all of those people's accounts were at Schwab, they would have known they were losing money month after month as opposed to gaining money month after month. So I just wanted to add that briefly.
That's a good point. I will say, though, that there are third-party custodians, especially for an IRA, who unfortunately don't take any responsibility for where the money goes. And in Restaurant Coin, I believe a large number of those investors were with a third-party custodian, and they still lost.
And they were probably a third-party custodian that nobody's ever heard of, right?
It was
very
that
small.
Is true.
Yeah, yeah.
That is true.
The article also talks about the FBI's role here in Utah. You work with a lot of victims of these crimes. Tell us how the FBI helps out in these situations, and then also explain to our audience, what happens to these victims? Some money's recovered, and how does that get distributed?
So the FBI is really the investigative arm for the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office here, and also for the SEC. The SEC has the primary regulatory oversight over these sorts of things on the federal level, and the state actually has an equivalent called the Utah Division of Securities. Both the SEC and the Utah Division of Securities have whistleblower laws that permit people to, if you have knowledge of bad conduct, and this happens all the time. I've filed a number of these cases in the last few years. People who worked for companies and they see something improper going on, and they can confidentially retain me or another attorney to file what's called a whistleblower claim. And that brings information to the regulatory agencies that they wouldn't otherwise have. And one of the big problems is that by the time the regulators get involved, most of the money is gone. In almost every case, the money's gone by the time the regulators shut them down. And at that point, it's too late. It's been gambled away in Vegas or hidden offshore or even just spent on cars. The Rick Kerver case, he liked to buy very exotic cars, and you know, those are hard to get money back out of. So the difficult part is that the regulators usually get in too late. By that time, the money's gone. What I try to tell people is if you have knowledge of fraud or you think you might be stuck in something that doesn't sound right or is too good to be true, you can get actually a financial award for being a whistleblower and bringing this to the attention of authorities. The cases that I get calls on, I would say recovery is always the hardest part. It depends on the situation. I've had cases where the investment that was a Ponzi or some sort of financial fraud was promoted by somebody who was employed at a big company, like a brokerage firm. We actually have situations where brokers, stockbrokers, are kind of doing a little business on the side or promoting something that wasn't approved by their firm. Customers don't always know that, but in those cases, those are the best cases in terms of the recovery scenario, because there's a big company out there with insurance or with deep pockets that can be used as a recovery. In other cases, there's criminal sanctions that can be brought. The SEC makes referrals to the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice. When they bring criminal charges, those people are typically make a plea bargain with the federal government, and as part of that plea bargain, they agree to pay back investors. So there can be a recovery that way. The problem is most of them don't have the money. So agreeing to pay people back and actually paying them are two different things. So we look for any opportunity. We look at errors and omissions insurance held by individuals who have offered these things. We look at, in some cases, we go after their houses. Unfortunately, that's not, there's never big money there, but there's something sometimes to help people. But that's the hard part. It's much, much easier to stay out of one of these than to recover your money when it all goes bad. That's the bottom line. Prevention is much easier than the cure.
One of the things that I read in the wake of the Madoff scandal was that early investors who had received money out of the scheme before it fell apart were being subject to recoveries. So yeah. Is that something that often happens where some investor who was completely innocent put some money in, got some money out, can face lawsuits against them?
Yes. In fact, in the Rust Rare coin case, that's happening right now. A number of investors that I represent are what we call winners, meaning they got their money out before the scheme collapsed, and they're getting sued by the receiver for those monies. It is a really difficult thing to explain to people, but the easiest way probably to explain it is the money they got wasn't actually from the business. It was from other people. The money that they got out of that scam came from other unfortunate investors who put their money in at the same time they were getting their money out. So what the courts try to do is impose this equitable remedy, which is to pull back all the money from the people who made money and then redistribute it so it's more even, the losses are even. I will say, though, that in those cases, the people that got their money out usually end up better off than the people that lost, because they get to keep up to the amount that they put in. So if you put in $1 million and took out five, you give the $4 million profit back, but you get to keep your $1 million. And frankly, in that scenario, those folks who keep their original investment are much, much better off than the people who are trying to get, you know, pennies on the dollar out of their investment.
Mark, do you have a feel? The Madoff scandal is one that's made the press. Most of our audience has heard of that. What did those people recover as far as pennies on the dollars? Was it 10 cents? Was it 1 cent? Was it 50 cents?
The Madoff case, and there's a similar case here in Utah that ended up this way, are unusual in Ponzi schemes. I tell people that if you get caught up in a Ponzi scheme and you can get 10 cents on the dollar back, you should be jumping for joy. Madoff, the last report I said there, they've gotten all their money back. Almost all of the investors got all their money back. The reason for that is that the receiver in that case, Irving Picard, was able to recover against a bunch of big hedge funds that had somehow contributed, and they were able to get damages against those hedge funds and other sources of recovery, and those folks have recovered all their money. So it's a very unusual thing. Most of the cases don't end up that way.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the Korber case. That's another Utah case. Can you describe that a little bit and tell us what the status of that one is?
Yeah, Rick Korber was a guy, I think it was about 10 years ago, I'm not sure on the dates, but he was out promoting this deal where he would buy homes that needed renovation, and he would flip them, and he was buying homes across the United States, and the money would go in and you would rehab a house and then he would sell it and it would make all this money. And he made I think he had some houses, but not very many. He was a real big promoter who used the LDS church as he used church terminology a lot. He used church people to hire. He hired church people to raise money from other people. The Mormon church was really infused in his scam in a way that is kind of unusual here, more than most. He would have big barbecues in front of his mansion in Alpine, Utah. He would have his Maserati and his Lamborghini parked out front, and he would be grilling hot dogs for the victims who would come. They didn't know they were victims. They thought they were investors. Unfortunately, the money was gone by the time that whole thing blew up. And what I always kind of laughed about was that what those folks didn't understand was that the Lamborghini they were looking at, they probably paid for it. But he was a real flashy guy who used to kind of bear his testimony about how great his investments were. He also owned a bunch of iceberg restaurants, kind of an interesting thing. Some people were given those as a way to get their money back. But, yeah, that was another one. And his case churned in the courts for years, and he's finally getting sentenced. They just postponed it, but he's going to get sentenced, I think, in about a month, and then he's going to go to prison for quite a while.
So in a scheme like this, what is and you know, you've dealt with a lot of victims. They're getting information back during the time they're getting ripped off. What kinds of things do these Ponzi scheme operators do to cause people to believe that they're making money?
Well, unfortunately, it's easy in this day and age to produce a statement. And so people do often get written statements in the mail that show that their investment that was worth, you know, $1 million is now worth $3 million or whatever it would be. So it's not hard to generate those statements. They're fictitious. They're not real in most cases, but people like to get a piece of paper with something on it that, you know, shows that they're doing well. The other thing that they do is they make payments. A lot of times Ponzi schemes give monthly payments of some sort to people, and new money comes in and it goes right back out the door to older investors. So people perceive that if they're getting something in writing and they're getting maybe a monthly payment or something that shows that their money is being plowed back into the investment, that they're safe and things are good. And unfortunately, those really can be faked, and it's not hard at all. You or I could do it tomorrow on our computer and send out statements to people that made it look like they were making a lot of money, even if they weren't. So those are easy.
All right. We've been speaking with Mark Pugsley on Ponzi schemes in Utah. I think he gave us some good advice on doing your diligence and, you know, always remembering that if it seems too good to be true, it probably isn't. Thank you for spending time with us, Mark.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
All right. Mountain Money will be right back after this.